Answers Magazine, Volume 9.3, page 54. Mysterious Natural Wonders, What Park Rangers Won't Tell You, by Andrew Snelling. Rare geologic wonders, like Delicate Arch, draw gawking tourists from around the world. If you ask a park ranger, how'd that happen? You're likely to hear all about millions of years. But there's something important he won't tell you. It didn't take millions of years. Arches of Utah. Located just outside Moab, Utah, is a wonderland of more than 2,000 natural arches. Towering 85 feet, 26 meters overhead, and spanning 65 feet, 20 meters, is the best-known rock arch in the world, Delicate Arch. Nearby is one of the world's longest natural arches, Landscape Arch, a whopping 291 feet or 89 meters long. Everywhere you turn are spectacular arches of various shapes and sizes, such as Double Arch, Skyline Arch, and Tower Arch. Why are there so many natural arches in this one area? How did it really happen? Evolutionary geologists recognize that massive earth movements were required, but they mistakenly assume long spans of time. The problem is that they have chosen to ignore the unique impact Noah's flood had upon the Earth's surface. Creating such delicate features requires more than gouging big holes into sandstone. A long series of events had to happen beforehand. First, some process had to create tall, thin rock walls, out of which the arches were carved. These rock walls are called fins. They appear in parallel rows, like the furrows of a plowed field, and we can still see some today. Only later did water, chemicals, and to a lesser extent, wind, eat away at these walls. In most cases, the whole wall would crumble, but in some cases, only the lower portions collapsed. Today, we're looking at the remains of these rows of walls, fins. Creating rows of rock walls requires special conditions. Sandstone must be deposited on top of less stable material, which then shifts upward and causes the sandstone to break up into parallel strips. Arches National Park sits atop thick underground salt beds, which are very unstable. During the flood, hot, salty waters deposited these beds in a wide basin in this area, now part of the Colorado Plateau region. After the flood deposited the salt beds, the waters tore debris from the nearby Uncompahgre Plateau, an Indian word meaning dirty water or rocks that make water red, and deposited the sands on top of the salt beds. These sediment layers included the Navajo sandstone and the Entrada sandstone. The weight of these accumulating rock layers caused the salt beds to liquefy and push up into salt domes. The arching and bending of the sand layers over the salt domes produced parallel fractures in the sandstone. Later, the flood deposited another mile of younger sediments, about 5,000 feet, 1,524 meters, on top of the Entrada sandstone. Next, this whole region was uplifted at the end of the flood, and the waters that rushed violently off the continent washed away most of the layers above the sandstone. The uplift further released pressure on the sandstone and caused gentle warping in the Entrada sandstone, opening up additional closely spaced parallel joints, 10 to 20 feet, 3 to 6 meters apart. Most arches are carved out of the Entrada sandstone, especially at the edges of the gentle hills that rose above the valley. Slightly acidic rainwater slowly broke down the sandstone's cement, made of lime, progressively releasing the sand grains. Such weathering and erosion by water and wind enlarged the fractures to produce narrow parallel sandstone walls, or fins. Frost and cycles of freezing and thawing caused expansion and contraction of the rock surfaces, which progressively peeled off, exfoliated. Eventually, holes appeared along the fractures that ran up and down the walls. The seeping water collected at the bases of the walls and evaporated slowly. All this extra water caused the bases to weather more rapidly than the tops. Fragments began to loosen and fall, enlarging the openings into holes, and then arches. Alternately, some of the holes may have appeared at the bottoms of the fins in places where the fins had filled in with sand and soil. Acidic water in the sand and soil wore away these holes while the fins were still underground. Later, the sand soil was removed, exposing the arches. Eventually, arches will wear through and collapse. 43 arches have collapsed due to erosion since 1970. Their loss is a sober reminder how delicate and recent these formations are. Rapid processes created them and are now destroying them. Other famous arches and bridges include Rainbow Bridge near Page, Arizona, Shipton's Arch in China, the tallest at 1,200 feet, and Aloba Arch in Chad, the second tallest arch at 394 feet.
The Devil's Marbles. An early Australian explorer trekking into central Australia found large round boulders scattered across the surface, sometimes in huge stacks, and sometimes precariously balanced on a tiny base. He reported in amazement, "This is the devil's country. He has even emptied his bag of marbles around the place." And the name stuck. The Devil's Marbles are an iconic landmark in Australia's outback. The local indigenous Australians call the region Karlu Karlu, round boulders, and consider it a sacred site. A dreaming story says the Devil Man created these features when he left twirled clusters of hair on the ground that became round boulders. Evolutionary geologists say the rocks formed deep in the earth 1.7 billion years ago, and then erosion over long ages produced these features at the surface. How did it really happen? The erosion of the granite in the conventional geologic story does explain the boulders, but not the timing of their formation, because it leaves out God's record about his catastrophic interventions in the past. It fails to recognize how quickly these things occurred. Two catastrophic episodes in Earth history could explain when granite formed rapidly, when God formed dry land on day 3 of creation week, and during the global watery cataclysm of Noah's day. This granite mass likely formed during the creation week. The actual science behind these boulders is pretty straightforward. Deep in the Earth's crust, its thin outer skin, the temperatures and pressures were so high that the rocks sometimes melted to form granite magma or molten rock. This magma then squeezed upwards along fractures and collected wherever spaces were forced to open up close to the Earth's surface. There, the granite magma cooled and crystallized to form the rock called granite. These granite masses shrunk a little as they cooled and crystallized, but no cracks opened up because the immense weight of the overlying rock layers pushed the rock mass tightly together. However, once the overlying rock layers eroded away during the flood, the release of weight allowed cracks to open up. Because of the regular pattern of mineral crystals in granite, the cracks followed an even and geometric pattern. The granite mass broke up into many large blocks, roughly cubic in shape. Many of these blocks wore away quickly under the heavy rains and harsh conditions that immediately followed the flood. Water carried chemicals down into the cracks, causing the granite to weather and decay rapidly. Two processes sped up the breakdown. The surfaces constantly expanded and contracted as a result of chemical weathering and the daily temperature fluctuations. In today's desert environment, the heat of the sun causes the thin outer skins of the blocks, along with the minerals in them, to expand slightly. After nightfall, they contract slightly. The outer skins eventually cracked and fell off, rounding the boulders so they look like peeling onions. These processes together are thus called spheroidal, or onion skin, weathering. The net result is the piles of perched and rounded granite boulders, or tors. Other famous rounded boulders attract tourists to Dartmoor in England, Skitskoppe, Namibia, Africa, Kitmakai in Kenya, Africa, and Giant Marbles at Joshua Tree National Park, California, USA. Giant's Causeway. The Giant's Causeway, Northern Ireland's most iconic landmark, has attracted millions of curious travelers over the centuries. Some 40,000 strange, interlocking columns form a road of stepping stones that lead from the coastal cliffs down into the sea. The edges of each column line up so perfectly they look like the work of a skilled Inca mason. Legend has it that Irish giant Finn MacCool built the causeway so he could travel across the sea to fight a challenger in Scotland without getting his feet wet. Similar columns rise from the sea in the Scottish Isles. Evolutionary geologists say the causeway was formed by massive volcanic eruptions 50 to 60 million years ago. How did it really happen? The first clue is that these columns are made out of basalt, a rock formed from cooling lava. When we observe lava cooling today, it shrinks and cracks. Under the right conditions, uniform mineral content, and slowly falling temperatures, the cracks follow geometric patterns. As the lava contracts, fractures first appear on the surface. Then, the cracks extend deeper into the mass as it cools, forming the pillar-like columns. The columns contracted at the bottom and top simultaneously. This would mean that the bottom shrank upward while the top shrank downward. In many cases, the bottom is convex, as expected, while the upper segment is concave, producing what are called ball and socket joints. In theory, based on how cooling lavas should behave, the basalt columns should all be six-sided, hexagonal. However, nearly one-third are five-sided, or pentagonal. And a few others are four, seven, and eight-sided. This goes to show that real-world geology doesn't always follow our initial simple theories. Most columns are about 15 to 20 inches, or 38 to 51 centimeters, in diameter, around the size of a common patio stone. The size of the columns was primarily determined by the speed at which the lavas cooled. And not all the columns are vertical. Some are tilted where the cooling surface was sloped. Several lines of evidence indicate that Giant's Causeway formed during several volcanic eruptions that occurred in rapid succession. After each eruption, the thick basalt started to congeal, cool, and harden, aided by being briefly covered with water before the next lava flow covered it. The middle flows in the sequence are slightly different in content than the others, and these are the ones that consist of regular, well-developed columns, particularly in the lower parts. The causeway is part of a massive basalt deposit, known as the Thulean Plateau, estimated to cover 700,000 square miles, or 1.8 million square kilometers, and be nearly half a mile thick. Where did all this material come from? We simply don't see anything on that scale today. The flood of Noah's day produced just the right conditions. As the Earth's plates moved rapidly apart, opening up the Atlantic Ocean, huge fissures opened in the crust. Massive amounts of thick lava flowed through these openings into the North Atlantic, covering Greenland, Iceland, Western Scotland, and Northeast Ireland. These land areas were closer together then, but shifted apart as the plates continued to move at the flood's end, and rapidly decelerated in the early post-flood era. The basalt lavas here did not erupt violently, but instead poured out of the ground like a thin oil, similar to the volcanoes in Hawaii today, but on a much larger scale. Eruptions were intermittent in pulses, as seven successive flows, most of them measuring nearly 100 feet or 30 meters thick, stacked on top of one another. Later erosion exposed some of the columns that formed within these layers. Other famous basalt columns include Devil's Postpile, California, Devil's Tower, Wyoming, Svartifoss, Black Fall in Iceland, and Basalt Island, Hong Kong.
Hoodoos of Bryce Canyon. The visitor overlooks at Bryce Canyon, Utah, provide a breathtaking spectacle of row upon row of towering columns, painted pink, red, white, and orange. Together, these columns were formed in a series of horseshoe-shaped amphitheaters cut into the surrounding cliffs. The largest and most spectacular is Bryce Amphitheater, about 12 miles, 19 kilometers wide, and 800 feet, 254 meters deep, sporting thousands of columns. It is hard to capture in photographs the exquisite beauty of such a vast and devastated landscape. Particularly stunning are the delicate hoodoos, slender columns with balancing hats on them that look ready to fall, and sometimes do. Native American legends say these statues were the Legend People, animals that took on human form, but committed a wicked deed and were turned into stone. Some were standing in rows, some sitting, and some clutching each other. You can still see the red paint on their faces. Evolutionists and flood geologists both say these colorful layers formed at the bottom of a lake, and that tectonic forces later pushed up the layers, exposing them to erosion. Evolutionists say this erosion occurred over millions of years. How did it really happen? Yes, these layers were deposited by water, and catastrophic earth movements exposed them to rapid erosion. But God's Word gives us other clues necessary to understand the whole story. Before looking at the details, it's important to understand that Bryce is not, strictly speaking, a canyon. It's actually the edge of a high plateau, Paunsagunt Plateau, an arm of the even greater Colorado Plateau. This plateau rose up at the end of the flood as the last waters receded, and Bryce was eroded into its side. The top of this plateau consists of the pink and white layers of the Clarion Formation. The pink is due to the iron and manganese in the sediments, which reacted with oxygen. The hoodoos were carved out of these layers. The Clarion Formation was likely among the first sediment layers deposited in the very early post-flood period, immediately after the last flood waters receded. This plateau region was rising up around the same time, creating natural dams that produced massive lakes in the continent's interior, including the Green River lakes of Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado. The waters eventually broke through the dams, surging away from the edges of the Paunsagunt Plateau. Subsequently, the water draining out of the bases of the plateau would have completed the carving of the cliffs and amphitheaters at Bryce, a process of headward erosion, technically known as sapping. Conditions at the edges of these cliffs are optimal for erosion. The layers of the Clarion Formation vary in hardness, with softer mudstones alternating with harder sandstones or limestones. When the mudstones wash away, other rocks collapse more readily and wash away too. The steep slopes increase the speed and energy of the rainwater running off the top. In the early years after the flood, superstorms ravaged the earth and eroded it much faster than we see today. As the rain passes through the atmosphere, it becomes weakly acidic. That acid eats away at the sediments, especially the limy layers. Furthermore, the sedimentary layers at Bryce contain several sets of parallel cracks, called joints. Water enters these cracks, where it freezes at night and thaws during the day. Today, the region experiences 200 freeze-thaw cycles per year, further weakening the rock layers. As the water flows downward, it picks up debris and scours any softer rocks it encounters, creating gullies. The gullies widen into canyons, exposing more surfaces to erosion along their vertical cracks. Further freeze-thaw cycles expand the cracks and peel off side layers, especially of the softer rocks. Normally, we would expect weathered rocks to collapse into piles, rather than leaving behind tall, slender columns. The key to producing these marvels is putting a harder rock layer, a cap, on top of the soft layers. This prevents the soft rocks from wearing away so quickly. The caps on Thor's hammer and the Hunter, for example, are made of harder rock. Hoodoos are common in the Colorado Plateau and in the Badlands of the USA. Other spectacular examples are in Cappadocia, Turkey, the Alpes de Haute-Provence, France, Serbia, Taiwan, and Drumheller, Alberta, Canada. Cotton Castle. Every year, Cotton Castle in Turkey attracts a million visitors who are eager to see its spectacular stepped terraces and frozen waterfalls, or to find refreshment in its oyster-shaped mineral pools. Today, the region is called Pamukkale, Turkish for Cotton Castle. But in New Testament times, it was part of the thriving city of Hierapolis, famed for the healing qualities of its hot mineral springs. In Revelation chapter 3, verses 15 through 16, Christ condemned the church at Laodicea for not being hot, like the healing waters flowing down from nearby Hierapolis. This elaborate white castle sprawls more than a mile, 8,860 feet, 2,700 meters, across the hillside. Its blazing white stones really do look like a magical castle floating in the clouds. Evolutionary geologists say it formed slowly over tens of thousands of years as chemicals in the water precipitated out. How did it really happen? Pamukkale's white terraces are made of travertine, a form of calcium carbonate commonly used as a decorative stone in buildings and homes. This travertine is deposited by mineral-rich water from hot springs. Calcium carbonate is also the main component of eggshells, seashells, and the lime in fertilizer. 17 hot water springs are just upstream of the terraces. The water temperatures range from slightly warm, 95 degrees Fahrenheit, 35 degrees Celsius, to boiling, 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius. Gushing from the springs, this hot water is full of dissolved calcium carbonate. It flows to the head of the terraces, which appear on a sloping cliff. There, it starts depositing the calcium carbonate as it cascades into each terrace level, even leaving behind a few frozen waterfalls. Underground volcanic activity generates the heat in the hot springs. The volcanic waters dissolve calcium carbonate as they pass through limestones. When the water reaches the surface, it is supersaturated with calcium carbonate. As the water then flows downstream, carbon dioxide escapes from it. The water deposits the calcium carbonate as a soft jelly, which eventually hardens into travertine. Many factors influence the rate of this reaction, including weather conditions, surrounding temperature, and the flow duration. The production of jelly continues until the carbon dioxide in the water is the same as the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It has been calculated that about 25 gallons of water is needed to produce 1 pound of travertine. At today's flow rate, over 2 tons of travertine are deposited daily. Spread evenly over the terraces, that means about 1/10 of an inch, 3 millimeters of travertine is added each day. As the earth recovered from the flood, the flow of heat and water would have been much greater in the early years. Such conditions would have increased the rate of deposit dramatically, generating terraces more rapidly than today. The terraces at Pamukkale are rare, but not unique. Mammoth Hot Springs in Yellowstone has produced similar white travertine terraces. New Zealand was also famous for its spectacular pink and white terraces, located in the famed Rotorua area of North Island, until they were destroyed by a volcanic eruption in 1886. This loss is a sober reminder that these delicate beauties require a rare combination of conditions. They were made possible by conditions in the early years after the flood, but are threatened by our still changing Earth. These are very recent features, not the product of steady geologic forces working slowly over long ages. Travertine terraces appear in other active geothermal regions, such as Mammoth Hot Springs in Yellowstone, Wyoming, and Huanglong Valley in China. The famed pink and white terraces near Rotorua, New Zealand, were destroyed by a volcanic eruption in 1886. Dr. Andrew Snelling holds a PhD in geology from the University of Sydney and has worked as a consultant research geologist in both Australia and America. Author of numerous scientific articles, Dr. Snelling is now Director of Research at Answers in Genesis USA.